This is Radio MD COVID-19 Daily, your source for COVID-19 news from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Caitlin White. It's once again Friday. It's April 3rd, another week of social distancing down. After the news, we'll go to some interviews on the possible benefits of hydroxychloroquine and what happens after we flatten the curve. We'll discuss with a physician. Clothing brands and other manufacturers are quickly shifting their workforces to produce masks during the pandemic, and that now includes Mattel and Fisher-Price. The toy companies are converting a part of their workforce and production lines into making masks to feed the urgent need for medical supplies in the U.S. All that fabric that was once for Barbie's clothes will go to protecting the faces of people across the nation. Right now, the CDC only suggests healthcare workers and those who believe they may be sick with the virus to wear masks. But reports say they are reviewing those guidelines now. However, on Thursday, President Trump said those guidelines would still be voluntary. As unemployment numbers continue to rise with businesses shutting down or putting employees on furlough, how will all of those people pay for or access health insurance? Radio MD's Scott Webb has more.
If you are recently unemployed, you likely have questions about who will pay for your COVID-19 testing, should it be necessary, and if you test positive, who's going to pay your medical bills at a time when you can least afford them. Recent bills passed by Congress ensure that people won't have to pay out of pocket for any COVID-19 testing, even if they're uninsured, but there's nothing that would cover treatment costs for people without insurance. Recommendations range from checking what your state or insurer has done to protect health coverage during COVID-related lockdowns, and considering Medicaid. And in related news, as many as 14 insurance companies have waived cost-sharing payments related to COVID-19. These include Aetna, Cigna, Humana, and others. Reporting for Radio MD News, I'm Scott Webb.
We can only do so much to protect ourselves from coronavirus, but what if your roommate or family member ends up sick? Radio MD's Bill Klaproth has some tips for what to do if someone in your home gets the virus.
If someone in your home has COVID-19, how should you keep others safe? According to WebMD, designate a separate room where you can close the door if possible. Those who are not sick should use a different bathroom from those who are, if available. Try to make sure that any shared spaces in the home have good airflow. If possible, the sick family member should wear a face mask. And avoid sharing household items like dishes, cups, utensils, towels, bedding, and other items. Don't allow the sick family member to interact with or care for any pets in the home. Make sure you clean all high-touch surfaces regularly and wash laundry thoroughly. For Radio MD News, I'm Bill Klaproth.
And the FDA has updated blood donation rules for LGBTQ+ men, citing an urgent need for blood during the COVID-19 pandemic. Men can now donate blood after 3 months of no sexual activity with another man, down from the previous 12-month wait time. A cure for coronavirus has yet to be discovered, but you've probably heard in the news recently about a drug that has been helping some patients, hydroxychloroquine. Here to break down what exactly that drug does is Dr. Eddie Fadikov, a board-certified physician and nutritionist.
Hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine family is an anti-malaria drug that we give to people before they go on a trip somewhere where there's malaria. It's also used for lupus, and it's used for rheumatoid arthritis as well.
And so how is it helping patients with coronavirus? What are we seeing?
We're doing in some of the hospitals I'm working at here, too, as part of the protocol. You know, when the patients are intubated and are on a ventilator. And the theory is two theories. It decreases inflammation, the cytokine response that prevents intubation, or what it does is it actually decreases the virus to attach to the tissues in the lungs, right? So both of those mechanisms are what we think how it's helping. So it's making the infection rate lower for these patients.
So what happens in my body if I do take a dose of hydroxychloroquine?
That's a great question. So if you take the medication, let's just say what some of the studies are showing, if you take one dose, right, you take it today, you take your one dose today, the half-life of it is about 22 days. So it's in your body for about a couple of weeks, 3 weeks now, right? And most of it is in the lung tissue, the adrenal glands, and the liver, which is good because that's where the virus attacks in the lungs. So now let's just say you got the virus, but it's going to show a couple of weeks before you get symptoms. Now the drug can suppress the immune response in the lungs. So if you do get it, you're not going to have as much inflammation. You're not going to have as much inflammatory cascade or response, and you won't get ARDS. That's what we call acute respiratory distress syndrome, when you get a bunch of fluid in your lungs and you can't breathe and you require ventilation. That's the theory, and that's how we think that it's helping. Now the macrolide, the Z-Pak that they're thinking about adding to it, that helps inflammation. Well, we've given it to patients in studies with cystic fibrosis, with cancer patients, how it was not just the antibiotic, but it's a powerful anti-inflammatory, as if not more powerful than naproxen or ibuprofen is.
Is there any way that this could be used preventatively?
Yes, there's, you know, there's a lot of studies right now talking about treatment and adding a Z-Pak to it, an antibiotic with it. The studies came out in France and came out in China, and then there's studies there are saying this works. Some other studies it doesn't work. And my thing is, nobody's talking about prevention, right? We don't have enough ventilators in this country to have every single patient on a ventilator that comes in. If they're predicting the numbers that they say they are, we don't have enough ventilators. So instead of wait till they get on a ventilator and treat them, why not prophylactically give them a dose of hydroxychloroquine? They did some preliminary studies in China. They did some pharmacokinetic modeling to kind of get what a prophylactic dosage would look like and what actually hydroxychloroquine as a drug in nature, how long does it stay in the body? And that's why it's so effective for malaria, because I can give you one dose or two doses of it and you're okay for 2 to 3 weeks when you're on a trip. So the theory would be, if you were to take it once every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks, would be the theory to decrease in the inflammation enough that if you were to get COVID, right, not saying that you're going to be prevented from getting COVID, it would just be a mild infection. You wouldn't have to be intubated or required mechanical ventilation. So that's something we need to look into and do the studies. But from the animal data and some of the preliminary research coming out in China, it's very promising. And a lot of patients or a lot of people in the United States can feel more safer, right? Because if we're talking about chronic use of hydroxychloroquine, there's toxicity and side effects. But if you're just taking one day, once a month to prevent this, not much harm can come out of it, you know, if you don't have any cardiac histories.
So I know this is still so new and being tested, but why is this such a big deal? I feel like I'm seeing this pop up in the news a lot. Why is this so important, this discovery of how this might help?
So the study that they came out in China with actually was the first control group, right? They had people that took it and people that didn't take it. And that's the kind of research we like, blind placebo-controlled trials in the United States. And what they're seeing is the people who actually took the medication saved the day, right? Kind of how we take a medication for the flu, right? Hey, if you take this medication, your flu symptoms will go from 5 days to 3 days. Now what they're showing is one had 3.2 days, the other one had 2.2 days. So if you save a day, that's a day less in ventilation. That's a day less you have fever, the cough improved. And then not only that, the imaging, the chest x-ray improved as well, just by taking the 5-day protocol.
Great. Is there anything else you want to add just about what we're hearing about hydroxychloroquine?
Yeah, because you hear about hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, right? So hydroxychloroquine is a safer and better drug. It's more effective, more powerful than chloroquine. I guess I want to tell people that in China, it's part of the protocol for healthcare workers, right? They're working in the front lines. It's part of that in India as well. It's part of it in other countries as well. So it's part of France and a lot of host countries. And then now it's part of the United States. And we're talking about treatment. I think for the frontline workers that are afraid to have families, we should be talking about prophylaxis. We're really good at treating stuff around the world, but we should be better at prevention, because that would save a lot more money, a lot more time, and wouldn't have to have as much ventilators or so much hospital personnel.
Obviously, this is also new, but are you confident that this is helpful?
Yes, I think Dr. Stevens, his is not peer-reviewed yet, infectious disease doctor, he did a trial where he's actually showing that not only for treatment but prevention here in the United States that it's helping. Obviously, we need to have that peer-reviewed and have more data added to it. But I think the more and more people that are doing research, and if you take a safe medication, you know the side effects, and you just take one time a month, it's a lot less risk than if you take something for 5 days or for 10 days or for a whole month. And this medication I'm very familiar with because my own family member takes it for rheumatoid arthritis and been taking it for years. So I'm very familiar with this medication. I know all the side effects of the medication. And you're right, you have to get an EKG, make sure the heart's okay. But if you were to come to my office and say, hey, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm going to go to an area that's got malaria, I would give you a dose of it. right? I wouldn't have to do this whole big workup or all these testing. I would give you the dose of it. You'd come back from your trip from an area that had malaria, and that'd be the end of it, and you'd move on. But it's very different if I'm giving it to you every single day for a period of time, and I'm combining antibiotic that together can cause heart issues or arrhythmias.
Great. Well, doctor, thank you so much for your time. I'll let you get back to it, but we really appreciate just giving us a quick breakdown of all the stuff we're hearing in the news. As we all work to help flatten the curve, well, what happens next? How do we get back to normal? Bill Klaproth talked with Dr. Gonzalo Behrman, an epidemiologist and director of the Virginia Commonwealth University Health Infection Prevention Program.
Dr. Behrman, once we have flattened the curve, once these stay-at-home orders are lifted, we're not going to just be able to go completely back to normal right away. How is this going to work? People are still going to have coronavirus. We're not going to eradicate that in a month or two or three. How do we reassimilate ourselves back into society? How do we get back to a sense of normalcy?
Right. I think it'll be a stepwise approach to kind of reassimilating ourselves to our prior norm. But to do that, we also have to have other provisos in place. And I think we would have to have a system of surveillance and an assurance that we have the appropriate testing available so that if there is a concerns about resurgence of this disease, COVID-19, that we're able to quickly and promptly identify it and do the appropriate isolations. In addition, if we have a vaccine available sooner than later, that would certainly be hugely encouraging for allowing us to go back to kind of business per usual.
So when you say surveillance, are you talking about on an individual basis? Because right now we're shutting down whole communities, whole states even. What does surveillance mean to us? Help us understand that.
So what I'm saying is at present in the United States, we have more people sick than we're reporting because we're unable to test them. The testing availability is just not there. So if we go back or when we go back to business as usual, then as a proviso, we should have ability to test people should they manifest symptoms so we know that those symptoms are COVID-19 and not something else. And if they are COVID-19, we'll have a much better understanding of the amount of disease out there, which would be the prevalence, and we would have a better mechanism to say, okay, you're infected, you need to stay home, socially isolated, et cetera, et cetera. Those measures must be in place before we go back to business as usual.
So that type of testing and surveillance, that sounds like it could take a long time before we're ready to implement that on a wide scale in this country.
It could. Unfortunately, the U.S. is far behind other developed countries in testing capability at this time.
Okay, so we've got our work cut out for us. So I'm going to put you on the spot right now and ask you to pull out your trusty crystal ball, and I know there are no answers to this. Nobody really knows for sure. But what is your best educated guess on when we might get back to some form of normalcy?
So I would say, to begin with, that the crystal ball is fuzzy. However, my prediction is that within 3 months, we might start to normalize things. That's my prediction.
Well, all right. I think a lot of us know that we're going to be dealing with this for a long time, but if we can get a sense of normalcy within 3 months, that's a lot better than a year, I got to tell you.
A year would be tough. Now, in 3 months, we won't have a vaccine, but hopefully the most critical component, which will be the availability of testing, will be there in 3 months, and we will have a ramp up in the appropriate personal protective equipment. So healthcare workers, people working in healthcare feel that they can provide care in a very safe fashion.
And in 3 months, might we have a better protocol on how to treat this? We won't have all the answers, but maybe we'll learn when we see a COVID-19 patient, this is what we have to do first. This is what we have to do second. Might we have those types of answers within 3 months?
Yes, almost certainly within 3 months, we'll have a better understanding of which of the medications, either new medications or repurposed medications, can be used preferentially for severe cases of COVID-19.
And at this point, Dr. Behrman, is there anything you see that's giving you hope in the fight against COVID-19?
Well, I think that the reports that I'm seeing from other countries such as South Korea, Singapore, also Hong Kong, are also are encouraging that non-pharmacologic interventions are effective. I also am optimistic that we will eventually have better treatments or treatments that are approved and also a vaccine available within 12 months. But I also think it's important to stress that situations such as pandemics really require a collaborative effort It's really a collaborative sacrifice. And if we all are in this together to try to do the right things, not only for ourselves, but for our loved ones, through the non-pharmacologic interventions, we can significantly impact the rate of propagation of this virus in our country.
Well, we all play a part in this fight against COVID-19. Dr. Behrman, thanks for your time. For Radio MD News, I'm Bill Klaproth.
You can hear more from this interview, as well as others with the doctors at VCU Health, on their podcast at vcuhealth.org. This has been another episode of Radio MD COVID-19 Daily. If you want to reach out to us with thoughts or some news or even some good news, our email is covid19daily@radiomd.com. That's covid19daily@radiomd.com. We'll be with you once again Monday afternoon. Let yourself be lazy this weekend. I'm Caitlin White. Stay home and stay healthy.